Every month had passed. All you have to do is tell your story, Mrs. Pinkston said. Talk about what being African-American means to you. But I'm not African-American, Marjorie said. Though she couldn't exactly read the look on Mrs. Pinkston's face, Marjorie knew instantly that she had said the wrong thing. She wanted to explain it to Mrs. Pinkston, but she didn't know how. She wanted to tell Mrs. Pinkston that at home they had a different word for African-Americans, Akata, that Akata people were different from Ghanaians, too long gone from the mother continent to continue calling it the mother continent. She wanted to tell Mrs. Pinkston that she could feel herself being pulled away too, almost Akata, too long gone from Ghana to be Ghanaian. But the look on Mrs. Pinkston's face stopped her from explaining herself at all. Listen, Marjorie, I'm going to tell you something that maybe nobody's told you yet. Here, in this country, it doesn't matter where you came from first to the white people running things. You're here now, and here, black is black is black. She got up from her seat and poured them each a cup of coffee. Marjorie didn't really even like coffee. It was too bitter. The taste clung to the back of her throat, like it couldn't decide whether it wanted to enter her body or be breathed out of her mouth. Mrs. Pinkston drank the coffee, but Marjorie just looked at hers. Briefly, for only a second, she thought she could see her face reflected in it. That night, Marjorie went to see a movie with Graham. When he came to pick her up, she asked him if he would park his car one street over. She wasn't ready to tell her parents yet. Good idea, Graham said, and Marjorie wondered if his father knew where he was. When the movie ended, Graham drove her into a clearing in the woods. It was one of those places that other kids supposedly went to make out, but Marjorie had been through it a couple of times, and it was always empty. It was empty this night. Graham had a bottle of whiskey in his back seat, and though she detested the taste of alcohol, Marjorie sipped from it slowly. While she drank, Graham pulled out a cigarette. After he lit it, he kept playing with the lighter, making the fire appear, then disappear again. "Would you stop that, please?" Marjorie asked once he started waving the lighter around. "What?" Graham asked. "The lighter. Would you put it away, please?" Graham gave her a strange look, but he didn't say anything, and so she didn't have to explain. Ever since she had heard the story of how her father and grandmother got their scars, she had been terrified of fire. When she was just a little girl, the firewoman of her grandmother's dreams had haunted Marjorie's own waking hours. She had only heard about it from her grandmother's stories, on those days when they walked to the water, so that her grandmother could tell her what she knew of their ancestors. And yet Marjorie thought she could see the firewoman in the blue and orange glow of the stove, in hot coals, in lighters. She feared that the nightmares would come for her, too, that she, too, would be chosen by the ancestors to hear their family's stories. But the nightmares never came, and so, with time, her fear of fire had waned. But every so often she could still feel her heart catch when she saw fire, as though the firewoman's shadow still lurked. "What did you think of the movie?" Graham asked, putting the lighter away. Marjorie shrugged. It was the only response she could manage because she hadn't been thinking at all about the movie. Instead, she'd thought about the location of Graham's hands in relationship to the popcorn, or the armrest they shared. She'd thought about his laugh when he'd found something funny, about whether or not the tilt of his head toward the left, toward her, was an invitation for her to tilt her own head toward him, or to rest it on his shoulders. In the weeks they had spent getting to know each other, Marjorie had become more and more enamored with the blue of his eyes. She wrote poems about them. The blue, like ocean water, like clear sky, like sapphire. She couldn't capture it, At the movies, she had thought about how the only real friends she had were characters in novels, not real at all. And then Graham had appeared and swallowed up a bit of her loneliness with his blue whale eyes. The next day, she wouldn't for the life of her be able to remember what the movie was called.
"Yeah, I felt the same way," Graham said. He took a long drag from the whiskey bottle.
Marjorie wondered if she was in love. How could she know? How did anyone know? In middle school, she had been into Victorian literature, the sweeping romance of it. Every character in those books was hopelessly in love. All the men were wooing, all the women being wooed. It was easier to see what love looked like then, the embarrassingly grand, unabashed emotion of it. Now, did it look like sitting in a Camry sipping whiskey?
"You still haven't let me read any of your writing," Graham said.
He stifled a burp, passing the bottle back to Marjorie.
"I have to write a poem for Mrs. Pinkston's assembly next month.
Maybe you can read that one."
"That's a few weeks after prom, right?"
Her mouth went dry at the mention of the dance. She waited for him to say more, but he didn't, and so she just nodded.
"I'd love to read it. I mean, if you want me to."
The bottle was back in his hands, and though it was dark, Marjorie could make out the deeply wrinkled lines of his knuckles, turning red from clutching. That week the Bradford pear tree started to bloom. At school, everyone said they smelled like semen, like sex, like a woman's vagina. Marjorie hated the smell of them, a reflection of her virginity, her inability to liken the smell to anything other than rotting fish. Every year by summer she would grow accustomed to the smell, and by the time the blossoms fell, the smell would be nothing more than a distant memory. But then spring would come and the smell would resurface, loudly announcing itself. Marjorie was working on her poem for The Waters We Wade In when her father got a call from Ghana. Old lady was frail. Her caretaker couldn't tell if the dreams were the same or different. Old lady didn't leave the bed as often as she used to. She, the woman who had once been afraid of sleep. Marjorie wanted her family to go to Ghana immediately. She stopped writing the poem, snatched the phone away from her confused father, an act that on another day would have earned her a knock on the head, and demanded that the caretaker put old lady on the phone, even if it meant waking her.
"Are you sick?" she asked her grandmother.
"Sick? I will soon be dancing with you by the water this summer. How can I be sick?"
"You won't die."
"What have I told you about death?"
old lady said sharply into the phone, her voice sounding stronger than it had at the beginning of their conversation. Marjorie tugged at the cord. Old lady said that only bodies died. Spirits wandered. They found Asamando, or they didn't. They stayed with their descendants to guide them through life, to comfort them. Sometimes to scare them into waking from their fog of unloving, unliving. Marjorie reached for the stone at her neck, her ancestor's gift.
"Promise me you won't leave until I can see you again," Marjorie said.
Behind her, Yao placed a hand on her shoulder.
"I promise I will never leave you," old lady said.
Marjorie handed the phone back to her father, who gave her a strange look. She went back to her room. On her desk, the piece of paper that was supposed to hold a poem simply said, "Water, water, water, water." Marjorie and Graham went on another date, this time to the U.S. Space and Rocket Center. Graham had never been before, but Marjorie and her parents went once a year. Her mother liked to look at all the pictures of astronauts that lined the halls, and her father loved to walk through the museum
examining every rocket as though he were trying to learn how to build one himself. In some ways, Marjorie thought her parents had already traveled through space, landing in a country as foreign to them as the moon. Graham didn't heed the do-not-touch signs. He left ghostly fingerprints on fiberglass cases, prints that disappeared almost as soon as he left them.
America wouldn't have a space program if it weren't for the Germans, Graham said.
Do you miss Germany? Marjorie asked. Graham hardly ever talked about the place where he had done most of his growing up. He didn't wear the country on his sleeve the same way she wore Ghana on hers.
Sometimes. But military brats get used to moving around.
He shrugged and pressed his fingers against a case that held a spacesuit. Marjorie pictured his hand pushing through the glass, lifting his body into the case, fitting him into the suit, then losing gravity until his body started to float up. Up.
Marjorie?
What?
I said, would you ever move back to Ghana?
She thought for a moment of her grandmother and the sea, the castle. She thought of the frantic commotion of cars and bodies on the streets of Cape Coast, the wide-hipped women selling fish out of large silver bowls, and the young girls whose breasts had not yet come in walking down the road's median, pressing their faces into the windows of the taxis, saying, "Ice water. And please, I beg."
I don't think so.
Graham nodded and started to move forward onto the next case. Marjorie took his hand just as he was lifting it to press it against the fiberglass. She stopped him and said,
"I mostly just feel like I don't belong there. As soon as I step off the airplane, people can tell that I'm like them, but different, too. They can smell it on me."
"Smell what?" Marjorie looked up, trying to capture the right word.
"Loneliness, maybe. Or aloneness. The way I don't fit here or there. My grandmother's the only person who really sees me."
She looked down. Her hand was shaking. So she let go of Graham's. But he took it back. And when she looked up again, he was leaning down, pressing his lips to hers. For weeks, Marjorie waited for word about her grandmother. Her parents had hired a new caretaker to watch her every day, which only seemed to infuriate her. She was getting worse. Marjorie didn't know how she knew, but she knew. At school, Marjorie was quiet. She didn't raise her hand in any of her classes, and two of her teachers stopped her to ask if everything was all right. She brushed them off. Instead of eating lunch in the English lounge or reading in the library, she sat in the cafeteria, at the corner of a long rectangular table, daring anyone who passed by to do their worst. Instead, Graham came over and sat across from her.
"You okay?" he asked. "I haven't really seen you since..."
His voice trailed off, but Marjorie wanted him to say it. "Since we kissed. Since we kissed." That day, Graham was wearing the school's colors, an obnoxious orange, calmed only slightly by a soothing gray.
"I'm fine," she said.
"Are you worried about your poem?" he asked. Her poem was a collection of fonts on a piece of paper, an experiment in box lettering, cursive, all caps.
"No, I'm not worried about that."
Graham nodded carefully and held her gaze. She had come to the cafeteria because she wanted to be alone while surrounded by people. It was a feeling she sometimes liked, like stepping off the plane in Accra and being met by a sea of faces that looked like her own. For those first few minutes she would capture that anonymity. But then the moment would drop. Someone would approach her, ask her if he could carry her bag, if he could drive her somewhere, if she would feed his baby. While she stared back at Graham, A brunette girl Marjorie recognized from the hallways approached them.
"Graham?"
she asked.
"I don't normally see you here at lunch. I would remember seeing you."
Graham nodded, but didn't say anything. The girl had yet to notice Marjorie, but Graham's lack of attention pulled her glance away from him toward the person who had won it. She looked at Marjorie for only a second, but it was long enough for Marjorie to notice the wrinkle of disgust that had begun to form on her face.
"Graham," she whispered, as though lowering her voice would keep Marjorie from hearing. "You shouldn't sit here."
"What?"
"You shouldn't sit here. People will start to think..."
Again, a quick glance.
"Well, you know."
"No, I don't know."
"Just come sit with us," she said.
At this point she was scanning the room, her body language turning anxious.
"I'm fine where I am. I'm..."
"Go," Marjorie said. And Graham turned toward her. It was as if he had forgotten whom he had been arguing for in the first place, as if he'd been fighting simply for the seat, and not the girl who sat across from it.
"Go.
It's fine." And once she had said it, she stopped breathing. She wanted him to say no, to fight harder, longer, to take her hand across the table and run his reddened thumbs between her fingers. But he didn't.
He got up,
looking almost relieved. By the time Marjorie noticed the brunette girl slipping her hand into his to pull him along, they were already halfway across the room. She had thought Graham was like her, a reader, a loner. But watching him walk away with the girl, she knew he was different. She saw how easy it was for him to slip in unnoticed, as though he had always belonged there. Prom was themed The Great Gatsby. In the decorating days that preceded it, the school's floors were littered with sparkles and glitter. The night of the prom, Marjorie was sandwiched between her parents on their couch, watching a movie on the television. She could hear her parents whispering about her when she got up to make popcorn.
"Something's not right,"
Yao said. He had never been good at whispering. At regular volume, his voice was a boom from the belly, deep and loud.
"She's just a teenager. Teenagers are like this," Esther said.
Marjorie had heard the other LPNs at the nursing home where Esther worked talk like this, as if teenagers were wild beasts in a dangerous jungle. Best to leave them alone. When she came back, Marjorie tried to look brighter, but she couldn't tell if she was succeeding. The phone rang, and she rushed to pick it up. She had asked her grandmother to call her once a month as an assurance, even though she knew it was cumbersome for the old woman to have to do so. But when she answered the phone, she was greeted by Graham's voice.
"Marjorie?"
he asked. She was breathing into the phone, but she had yet to speak. What was there to say?
"I wish I could take you. It's just that..."
His voice trailed off, but it didn't matter. She'd heard it before. He was going to go with the brunette. He had wanted to take Marjorie, but his father didn't think it would be proper. The school didn't think it was appropriate. As a last defense, Marjorie had heard him tell the principal that she was not like other black girls. And somehow, that had been worse. She had already given him up.
"Can I still hear your poem?"
he asked.
"I'm reading it next week. Everyone will hear it."
"You know what I mean." In the living room, her father had started snoring. It was the way he always watched movies. She pictured him leaning down onto her mother's shoulders, the woman's arms wrapped around him. Maybe her mother was sleeping too, her own head leaning toward Yao's, her long box braids, a curtain, hiding their faces. Theirs was a comfortable love, a love that didn't require fighting or hiding, When Marjorie had asked her father again when he had known he liked Esther, he said he had always known. He said it was born in him, that he breathed it in with the first breeze of Ejiso, that it moved in him like the harmattan. There was nothing like love for Marjorie in Alabama. "I have to go," she said to Graham on the phone. "My parents need me." She clicked the phone onto its receiver and went back into the living room. Her mother was awake, staring ahead at the television, though she wasn't watching it. "Who was that, my own?" she asked. "No one," Marjorie said. The auditorium sat 2,000. From backstage, Marjorie could hear the other students filing in, the insistent chatter of their boredom. She was pacing the room, too scared to look out past the curtain. Beside her, Tisha and her friends were practicing a dance to music that played faintly from the boombox. "You ready?" Mrs. Pinkston asked, startling Marjorie. Her hands were already shaking, and she was surprised she didn't drop the poem she was holding. "No," she said. "Yes, you are," Mrs. Pinkston said. "Don't worry, you'll be great." She kept moving, off to check on all the other performers. When the program started, Marjorie's stomach began to hurt. She had never spoken in front of so many people before, and she was ready to attribute the pain to that. But then it settled more deeply. A wave of nausea accompanied it, but soon both passed. This feeling came from time to time. Her grandmother called it a premonition, the body registering something that the world had yet to acknowledge. Marjorie sometimes felt it before receiving a bad test score. Once, she got it before a car accident. Another time, she got it only moments before she realized she had lost a ring her father had given her. He argued that these things would have happened whether she had felt the feeling or not. And perhaps that was true. All Marjorie knew was that the feeling told her to brace herself. And so, bracing herself, she stepped onto the stage once Mrs. Pinkston introduced her. She knew the lights would be bright, but she had not factored in their heat, like a million brilliant suns shining down on her. She began to sweat, passed a palm across her forehead. She set her paper down on the podium. She had practiced a million times, under her breath in class, in front of the mirror in her bathroom, in the car while her parents drove. The sound of silence, cut by the occasional cough or shuffling of feet, taunted Marjorie. She leaned into the mic, she cleared her throat, and then she read. "Split the castle open. Find me, find you. We, too, felt sand, wind, air. One felt whipped, whipped, once shipped. We, too, black, me. You. One grew from cocoa soil, birthed from nut, skin uncut, still bleeding. We, too, weighed. The waters seem different, but are same. Our same. Sister skin. Who knew? Not me. Not you." She looked up. A door had creaked open, letting more light in. There was enough light for her to see her father standing in the doorframe, but not enough for her to see the tears running down his face. The only promise old lady Aquia, the crazy woman of Ejiso, broke, was the last one she made. She died in the middle of a sleep she used to fear. She wanted to be buried on a mountain overlooking the sea. Marjorie took the rest of the school year off, her grades so good it didn't make much of a difference. She walked with her mother behind the men who were tasked with carrying her grandmother's body up. Her father had insisted on carrying too, though he was so old, his presence was more of a burden than a help. When they got to the gravesite, the people began weeping. Everyone had been crying for days and days on end, but Marjorie had yet to. The men began digging out the red clay. Two mounds stood on either side of the big rectangular hole, growing deeper. A woodworker had crafted old lady's coffin in a wood the same color as the ground, and when the coffin was lowered, no one could tell where it ended, and the earth began. They began to return the clay to the hole. They packed it in tight, patting it with the back of the shovel once they had finished. The sound echoed off of the mountain into the valley. Once they put a marker on the grave, Marjorie realized that she had forgotten to drop in her poem, built from the dream stories old lady used to tell when she walked Marjorie to the water. She knew her grandmother would have loved to hear it. She pulled the poem from her pocket, and her trembling hands made the words wave even though there was little wind. Marjorie threw herself onto the funeral mound, crying finally,
Me mommy.
Her mother came to lift her up off the ground. Later, Esther told her that it looked like she was going to fly off the cliff, down the mountain, and into the sea. Marcus didn't care for water. He was in college the first time he saw the ocean close up, and it had made his stomach turn. All that space, that endless blue, reaching out farther than an eye could hold. It terrified him. He hadn't told his friends he didn't know how to swim, and his roommate, a redhead from Maine, was already 7 feet under the surface of the Atlantic before Marcus even stepped his toes in. There was something about the smell of the ocean that nauseated him. That wet salt stink clung to his nose and made him feel as though he were already drowning. He could feel it thick in his throat, like brine, clinging to that place where his uvula hung, so that he couldn't breathe right. When he was young, his father told him that black people didn't like water, because they were brought over on slave ships. What did a black man want to swim for? The ocean floor was already littered with black men. Marcus always nodded patiently when his father said things like this. Sonny was forever talking about slavery, the prison labor complex, the system, segregation, the man. His father had a deep-seated hatred of white people, a hatred like a bag filled with stones, one stone for every year racial injustice continued to be the norm in America. He still carried the bag. Marcus would never forget his father's early teachings, the alternative history lessons that got Marcus interested in studying America more closely in the first place. The two had shared a mattress in Ma Willie's cramped apartment. In the evenings, lying on the mattress with springs like knives, Sonny would tell Marcus about how America used to lock up black men off the sidewalks for labor, or how redlining kept banks from investing in black neighborhoods, preventing mortgages or business loans. So was it a wonder that prisons were still full of them? Was it a wonder that the ghetto was the ghetto? There were things Sonny used to talk about that Marcus never saw in his history books, but that later, when he got to college, he learned to be true. He learned that his father's mind was a brilliant mind, but it was trapped underneath something. In the mornings, Marcus used to watch Sonny get up, shave, and leave for the methadone clinic in East Harlem. It was easier to follow the movements of his father than it was to watch a clock. At 6:30 he got up and had a glass of orange juice. By 6:45 he was shaving, and by 7, he was out the door. He would get his methadone, and then he would head over to work as a custodian at the hospital. He was the smartest man Marcus knew, but he never could get completely out from under the dope he used to use. When he was 7, Marcus once asked Ma Willie what would happen if some part of Sonny's schedule was to change. What would happen if he didn't get the methadone? His grandmother just shrugged. It wasn't until Marcus was much older that he started to understand just how important his father's routine was. His entire life seemed to hang in this balance. Now Marcus was near the water again. A new grad schoolmate had invited him to a pool party to celebrate the new millennium, and Marcus had, hesitantly, accepted. A pool in California was safer than the Atlantic, sure. He could lounge on the chair and pretend he was just there for the sun. He could make jokes about how he needed a tan. Someone yelled, "Cannonball!" sending a cold, wet splash onto Marcus's legs. He wiped it off, grimacing, after Deontay handed him a towel.
"Shit, Marcus. How long we gonna stay out here, man? It's hot as hell. This some Africa heat right here."
Deontay was always complaining. He was an artist whom Marcus met at a house party in East Palo Alto. And even though Deontay had grown up in Atlanta, something about him reminded Marcus of home. They'd been like brothers ever since.
"We ain't been here but 10 minutes, D. Chill," Marcus said, but he was starting to feel restless too.
"No, nigga, I ain't about to burn up in this damn heat. Let me catch you later."
He got up and shot a small wave to the people in the pool. Deontay was always asking to go to school events with Marcus, and then leaving almost as soon as they arrived. He was looking for a girl he'd met at an art museum once. He couldn't remember her name, but he told Marcus that he could tell she was a schoolgirl, just from the way she talked. Marcus didn't feel the need to remind him that there were about 1 million universities in the area. Who could say the girl would end up at one of his parties? Marcus was getting his Ph.D. in sociology at Stanford. It was something he would never have been able to imagine doing back when he was splitting a mattress with his father. And yet, there he was. Sonny had been so proud when he told him he'd been accepted to Stanford that he cried. It was the only time Marcus had ever seen him do it. Marcus left the party soon after Deontay, making up some excuse about work. He walked the 6 miles home, and when he got there, he was sweating through his shirt. He got into the blue-tiled shower and let the water beat over his head, never lifting his face up toward it, still scared of drowning.
"Your mama says hi," Sonny said.
It was their weekly phone call. Marcus made it every Sunday afternoon, when he knew his Aunt Josephine and all the cousins would be in Ma Woolley's house cooking and eating after church. He called because he missed Harlem. He missed Sunday dinners. He missed Ma Woolley singing gospel at the top of her voice, as if Jesus would be there in 10 minutes if she would only just summon him to come fix a plate.
"Don't lie," Marcus said.
The last time he'd seen Imani was his high school graduation. His mother had dressed up in some outfit Ma Willie had given her, no doubt. It was a long-sleeved dress, but when she lifted her arm to wave at him while he crossed the stage to get his diploma, Marcus was almost certain he could see the tracks.
"Hmph," was all Sonny replied. "Y'all doing good over there?" Marcus asked. "The kids and all them okay?"
"Yeah, we good.
We good."
They breathed into the phone for a bit, neither wanting to speak, but neither wanting to hang up the phone either.
"You still straight?" Marcus asked. He didn't ask often, but he asked.
"Yeah, I'm good. Don't you worry about me.
Keep your head in them books. Don't be thinking about me."
Marcus nodded.
It took him a while to realize that his father wouldn't be able to hear that, and so he said, "Okay." And they finally hung up the phone. Afterward, Deontay came by to get him. He was dragging Marcus to a museum in San Francisco, the same one where Deontay had met the girl. "I don't know why you sweating this girl, Dee," Marcus said. He didn't really enjoy art museums. He never knew what to make of the pieces that he saw. He would listen to Deontay talk about lines and color and shading. He would nod, but really it all meant nothing to him. "If you saw her, you'd understand," Deontay said. They were walking around the museum, and neither of them was really taking in any of the art. "I understand she must look good." "Yeah, she looked good. But it ain't even about that, man." Marcus had already heard it before. Deontay had met the woman at the Kara Walker exhibit. The two of them had paced the floor-to-ceiling black paper silhouettes four times before their shoulders brushed on the fifth pass. They talked about one piece in particular for nearly an hour, never remembering to get each other's name. "I'm telling you, Marcus, you're going to be at the wedding soon. All's I got to do is find her." Marcus snorted. How many times had Deontay pointed out his wife at a party, only to date her for a week? He left Deontay to himself and wandered the museum alone. More than the art, he liked the museum's architecture. The intricate stairways and white walls that held works of vibrant colors. He liked the walking and the thinking that the atmosphere allowed him to do. He had been to a museum once on a class field trip back in elementary school. They'd taken the bus, then walked the remaining blocks on the buddy system, each child holding the next child's hand. Marcus could remember feeling awed by the rest of Manhattan, the part that wasn't his, the business suits and feathered hair. In the museum, the ticket taker had smiled at them from way up in the glass booth. Marcus had been craning his neck in order to see her, and she'd rewarded his efforts with a little wave. Once they'd gone inside, their teacher, Mrs. MacDonald, had led them through room after room, exhibit after exhibit. Marcus was at the end of the line, and Latavia, the girl whose hand he held, had dropped his in order to sneeze, and so Marcus had taken the opportunity to tie his shoe. When he lifted his head again, his class had moved on. Thinking back, he should have been able to find them quickly. A line of little black ducklings in the big white museum. But there were so many people, and all so tall, that he couldn't see his way around them, and he quickly grew too frightened to move. He was standing there, paralyzed and quietly crying, when an elderly white couple found him. "Look, Howard," the woman said. Marcus could still remember the color of the woman's dress, a deep, bleeding red that only served to scare him even more. "Poor thing's probably lost or something." She studied him carefully, said, "He's a cute one, isn't he?" The man, Howard, was carrying a slender cane, and he tapped at Marcus's foot with it. "You lost, boy?" Marcus didn't speak. "I said, you lost?" The cane kept hitting at his foot, and for a second, Marcus had felt as though at any moment the man would lift the cane all the way up toward the ceiling and send it crashing over his head. He couldn't guess why he felt that way, but it had scared him so badly he could start to feel a wet stream traveling down his pant legs. He'd screamed and ran from one white-walled room to another, until a security guard had chased him down, called the teacher over the intercom, and sent the whole class back out into the street, back onto the bus, back home to Harlem. Deontay found him after a while. "She ain't here," he said. Marcus rolled his eyes. What did he expect? The two of them left the museum. A month passed, and it was time again for Marcus to return to his research. He had been avoiding it because it wasn't going well. Originally,
He'd wanted to focus his work on the convict leasing system that had stolen years off of his Grandpa H's life. But the deeper into the research he got, the bigger the project got. How could he talk about great-grandpa H's story without also talking about his grandma Willie and the millions of other black people who had migrated north, fleeing Jim Crow? And if he mentioned the Great Migration, he'd have to talk about the cities that took that flock in. He'd have to talk about Harlem. And how could he talk about Harlem without mentioning his father's heroin addiction, the stints in prison, the criminal record? And if he was going to talk about heroin in Harlem in the 60s, wouldn't he also have to talk about crack everywhere in the 80s? And if he wrote about crack, he'd inevitably be writing, too, about the war on drugs. And if he started talking about the war on drugs, he'd be talking about how nearly half of the black men he grew up with were on their way either into or out of what had become the harshest prison system in the world. And if he talked about why friends from his hood were doing 5-year bids for possession of marijuana, when nearly all the white people he'd gone to college with smoked it openly every day, he'd get so angry that he'd slam the research book on the table of the beautiful but deadly silent Lane Reading Room of Green Library of Stanford University. And if he slammed the book down, then everyone in the room would stare and all they would see would be his skin and his anger, and they'd think they knew something about him, and it would be the same something that had justified putting his great-grandpa H in prison, only it would be different, too, less obvious than it once was. When Marcus started to think this way, he couldn't get himself to open even one book. He couldn't remember exactly when the need for studying and knowing his family more intimately had struck him. Maybe it was during one of those Sunday dinners at Ma Willie's house, when his grandmother had asked that they all hold hands and pray. He would be shoved between two of his cousins, or his father and Aunt Josephine, and Ma Willie would begin one of her prayers with a song. His grandmother's voice was one of the wonders of the world. It was enough to stir in him all of the hope and love and faith that he would ever possess, all coming together to make his heart pulse and his palms sweat. He'd have to let go of someone's hand in order to wipe his own hands, his tears. In that room with his family, he would sometimes imagine a different room, a fuller family. He would imagine so hard that at times he thought he could see them. Sometimes in a hut in Africa, a patriarch holding a machete, sometimes outside in a forest of palm trees, a crowd watching a young woman carrying a bucket on her head, sometimes in a cramped apartment with too many kids, or a small, failing farm around a burning tree, or in a classroom. He would see these things while his grandmother prayed and sang. And he would want so badly for all the people he made up in his head to be there, in that room, with him. He told his grandmother this after one of the Sunday dinners, and she told him that maybe he had the gift of visions. But Marcus never could make himself believe in the God of Ma Willie. And so he'd gone about looking for family and searching for answers in a more tangible way, through his research and his writing. Now Marcus jotted down a few notes and headed out to meet Deontay. His friend's mission to find the mysterious woman from the museum had ended, but his taste for parties and outings had not. They ended up in San Francisco that night. A lesbian couple, Deontay knew, had opened up their house into a gallery night Afro-Caribbean dance party. When they walked in, they were greeted by the tinny sound of large steel drums. Men with brightly colored kente cloths wrapped around their waists held drum mallets with round pink tips. A woman stood at the end of this row of men, wailing out a song. Marcus pushed farther in. The art on the walls frightened him a little,
though he would never admit it to Deontay if, or more likely when, his friend asked his opinion. The piece Deontay had contributed was of a woman with horns strung around a baobab tree. Marcus didn't understand it at all, but he stood under it for a short while, his head tilted to the left, nodding slightly whenever someone appeared next to him. Soon the person next to him was Deontay. His friend poked him in the shoulder repeatedly, all the jabs in quick succession, so that he had finished before Marcus could tell him to stop.
"What, nigger?"
Marcus said, turning to look at him. It was like Deontay didn't even realize someone else was there. His body was angled away, and he suddenly turned it back toward Marcus.
"She's here."
"Who?"
"The fuck you mean who? The girl, man. She's here."
Marcus turned his gaze toward where Deontay was pointing. There were two women standing side by side. The first was tall and skinny, light-skinned, like Marcus himself was, but with dreadlocks that drifted down past her ass. She was playing with her locks, twirling them around her finger, or taking the whole lot of them and piling them onto the very top of her head. The woman next to her was the one who caught Marcus's eye. She was dark, blue-black, they would have called her on playgrounds in Harlem. And she was thick, with sturdy, large breasts, and a wild afro that made her look as though at some point very recently she had been kissed by lightning.
"Come on, man," Deontay said, already walking toward the women.
Marcus walked a little bit behind him. He could see Deontay trying to play it cool. The calculated slouch, the careful lean. When they got to the women, Marcus waited to see which one was the one.
"You,"
the woman with the dreadlocks said, slapping Deontay's shoulder.
"I thought I recognized you, but I couldn't remember where I would have known you from,"
Deontay said. Marcus rolled his eyes.
"We met at the museum a couple of months ago,"
the woman said, smiling.
"Right, right, of course,"
Deontay said. He was on his best behavior now, standing straight and smiling. "I'm Deontay, and this is my friend Marcus." The woman flattened her skirt and picked up another lock, started to twirl it around her finger, preening, it seemed. The woman next to her hadn't said a word yet, and her eyes were mostly trained on the ground, as though if she didn't look at them, she could pretend they weren't there.
"I'm Key," the dreadlocked woman said, "and this is my friend Marjorie."
At the mention of her name, Marjorie lifted her head, the curtain of wild hair parting to reveal a lovely face and the beautiful necklace.
"Nice to meet you, Marjorie," Marcus said, extending his hand.
When Marcus was just a little boy, his mother, Amani, had taken him for the day. Stolen him, really, for Ma Willie and Sonny and the rest of the family had no idea that Amani, who had asked just to say hi, would lure him away from the apartment with the promise of an ice cream cone. His mother couldn't afford the cone. Marcus could remember her walking with him from one parlor to another shop, to another, and another, in the hope that the prices would be better at a place just a little bit farther down. Once they reached Sonny's old neighborhood, Marcus knew two things with certainty. First, that he was somewhere he was not supposed to be, and second, that there would be no ice cream. His mother had dragged him up and down 116th Street, showing him off to her dope fiend friends, the broke jazz crew.
"This your baby?"
one fat, toothless woman said, squatting so that Marcus was looking straight down the barrel of her empty mouth.
"Yep, this Marcus."
The woman touched him, then waddled on. Amani kept navigating him through a part of Harlem that he knew only through stories, through the salvation prayers the church congregants put up each Sunday. The sun got lower and lower in the sky. Amani started crying and yelling at him to walk faster, though he was going as fast as his little legs could carry him.
It was nearly dusk before Ma, Willie, and Sonny found him. His father had snatched his hand and tugged him away so fast he thought his arm would escape its socket. And he'd watched as his grandmother struck Imani hard across the face, saying loud enough for anyone to hear, "Touch this child again and see what happens." Marcus thought about that day often. He was still amazed by it. Not by the fear he'd felt throughout the day, when the woman who was no more than a stranger to him had dragged him farther and farther from home, but by the fullness of love and protection he'd felt later, when his family had finally found him. Not the being lost, but the being found. It was the same feeling he got whenever he saw Marjorie, like she had somehow found him. Months had passed, and Deontay and Key's relationship fizzled, leaving only Marcus and Marjorie's friendship as evidence of its ever having been. Deontay teased Marcus about Marjorie constantly, saying, "When you gonna tell that girl you into her?" But Marcus couldn't explain to Deontay that it wasn't about that, because he didn't really understand himself what it was about. "So this is the Ashanti region," Marjorie said, pointing to a map of Ghana on her wall. "This is technically where my family's from, but my grandmother moved down to the central region right here to be closer to the beach."
"I hate the beach," Marcus said.
At first Marjorie smiled at him, like she was going to start laughing, but then she stopped, and her eyes turned serious. "Are you scared of it?" she asked. She let her finger drift slowly from the edge of the map down to the wall. She rested her hand against the black stone necklace she wore every day. "Yeah, I guess I am," Marcus said. He had never told anyone before. "My grandmother said she could hear the people who were stuck on the ocean floor talking to her, our ancestors. She was kind of crazy." "That don't sound crazy to me." "Shit. Everybody in my grandma's church caught a spirit at one point or another. Just because somebody sees or hears or feels something other folks can't, doesn't mean they're crazy. My grandma used to say, 'A blind man don't call us crazy for seeing.'" Now Marjorie gave him a real smile. "You want to know what I'm scared of?" she asked. And he nodded. He had learned not to be surprised by how forthcoming she was, how she never gave in to small talk, just dove right into deep waters. "Fire," she said. He had heard the story of her father's scar in the first week of meeting Marjorie. Her answer didn't surprise him. "My grandmother used to say we were born of a great fire. I wish I knew what she meant by that." "You ever get back to Ghana?" "Oh, I've been busy with grad school and teaching and all of that." She paused and looked into the air, counting. "I haven't been back since my grandmother died, actually," she said softly. "She gave me this. A family heirloom, I guess." Marjorie pointed to the necklace. Marcus nodded. So that was why Marjorie never took it off. It was getting late, and Marcus had work to do, but he couldn't move from this particular spot in Marjorie's living room. There was a large bay window that let in so much light that his shoulder felt brushed with warmth. He wanted to stay for as long as he could. She would have hated to know that it's been so long, almost 14 years. "When my parents were alive, they used to try to make me go, but it was too painful, losing her. And then I lost my parents, and I guess I just didn't see the point anymore. My tree's so rusty. I don't know if I could even get around anyway." She forced a laugh, but looked away as soon as it escaped her lips. She hid her face from him for what seemed like a long stretch of time. The sun finally reached a place where the window couldn't catch its light. Marcus could feel the heat lifting off of his shoulder. And he wanted it back. Marcus spent the rest of the school year avoiding his research. He couldn't see the point anymore. He had gotten a grant that would take him to Birmingham so that he could see what was left of Pratt City. He went with Marjorie, and all they'd been able to find was a blind and probably crazy old man who claimed he knew Marcus's great-grandpa, H., when he was just a boy. "You could do your research on Pratt City," Marjorie had suggested when they left the man's house. "Seems like an interesting town." When the old man had heard Marjorie's voice, he said he wanted to feel her, that this was how he got to know a person. Marcus had watched, amazed and somewhat embarrassed, as she let the man run his hands along her arms and finally, her face, like he was reading her. It was her patience that had amazed him. In the short time that he'd known her, he could already tell that she had enough patience to take her through almost any storm. Marcus sometimes studied with her in the library, and he would watch out of the corners of his eyes as she devoured book after book after book. Her work was in African and African-American literature, and when Marcus asked her why she chose those subjects, she said that those were the books that she could feel inside of her. When the old man touched her, she had looked at him so patiently, as though while he read her skin, she was also reading him. "That's not the point," he said. "What is the point, Marcus?" She stopped walking. For all they knew, they were standing on top of what used to be a coal mine, a grave for all the black convicts who had been conscripted to work there. It was one thing to research something, another thing entirely to have lived it, to have felt it. How could he explain to Marjorie that what he wanted to capture with his project was the feeling of time, of having been a part of something that stretched so far back, was so impossibly large, that it was easy to forget that she and he and everyone else existed in it, not apart from it, but inside of it? How could he explain to Marjorie that he wasn't supposed to be here, alive, free? That the fact that he had been born, that he wasn't in a jail cell somewhere, was not by dint of his pulling himself up by the bootstraps, not by hard work or belief in the American dream, but by mere chance. He had only heard tell of his great-grandpa H. from Ma Willie, but those stories were enough to make him weep and to fill him with pride. Two Shovel H., they had called him. But what had they called his father, or his father before him? What of the mothers? They had been products of their time, and walking in Birmingham now, Marcus was an accumulation of these times. That was the point. Instead of saying any of this, he said, "You know why I'm scared of the ocean?" She shook her head. "It's not just because I'm scared of drowning, though I guess I am. It's because of all that space. It's because everywhere I look, I see blue, and I have no idea where it begins. When I'm out there, I stay as close as I can to the sand, because at least then I know where it ends." She didn't speak for a while, just continued walking a little bit ahead of him. Maybe she was thinking about fire, the thing she had told him she most feared. Marcus had never seen so much as a picture of her father, but he imagined that he had been a fearsome man with a scar covering one whole side of his face. He imagined that Marjorie feared fire for the same reasons he feared water. She stopped beneath a broken lamppost that flickered an eerie light on and off, and on and off. "I bet you would like the beach in Cape Coast," she said. "It's beautiful there. Not like anything you would see in America." Marcus laughed. "I don't think anyone in my family's ever left the country. I wouldn't know what to do on a plane ride that long." "You mostly just sleep," she said. He couldn't wait to get out of Birmingham. Pratt City was long gone, and he wasn't going to find what he was looking for in the ruins of that place. He didn't know if he would ever find it. "All right," he said. Let's go.
Excuse me, sir. You won't go see Slave Castle. I take you see Cape Coast Castle. 10 cities, sir. Just 10 cities. I take you see nice castle.
Marjorie was rushing him through the Trotro stop, hurrying them toward a cab that would take